You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Elmaz Abinader. Elmaz, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Elmaz, tell me a little bit about what you're working on now. It seems you have another project. We could talk about Voices of Our Nation or your writing. Where should we start? Or maybe there's probably a number of things you're working on. So just to give us an overview, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm in the midst of completing a novel, which I'm very excited about. So I love the opportunity to talk about it. It has a nice backstory. I have a cousin who was engaged to a woman in Lebanon who had to stay during the Civil War while he got his residency and then sent for her so they can get married. And it took a long time. So she had experienced, his fiance, had experienced...
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt, but you said he got his residency. Is that as a residency in what sense?
In the U.S. So he was trying to get his residency card in the U.S.
Okay.
And and his fiance was in Lebanon. And while she was in Lebanon, she was experiencing the war and all of its problems, its challenges. She spent hours, days in bomb shelters. Her family had to move a number of times. Her father had already passed away, and he left a family of women. So it was a huge struggle. So when she finally came to the United States, she settled with my cousin. They got married. They lived in a really nice suburb in New Jersey. She immediately got a job. Everything seemed to work out really well. One encounter with her at a party, I asked her how it's going, and she said, "I miss the war." So that sentence, "I miss the war," was a jumping off point for my imagination of what was it like for someone to endure these huge and enormously horrifying challenges, to be traumatized in the way she was traumatized, and to come to a life that was peaceful and organized, and for them, pretty satisfying because they moved up quickly in the companies they were in. They're pretty bright. And to be longing for something amidst all of this kind of stability, to be longing for something so chaotic and so unstable. So based on that, my book takes place, it's called Almost a Life. It takes place in two parts. I develop somewhat of my character's life. Her name is Desdemona, in the war with her sisters and mother, moving away from the fighting, trying to hide, going through some destruction of their property and so on. And then I move her to the U.S. and then try to imagine what it was like to be with this man you haven't seen for 4 years, to look at this life that didn't have companionship but gave you other kinds of things. So I really appreciated that moment, that inspiration that has allowed me to develop this story in the way that it has. So I'm working on my final draft, so I'm at a really exciting point right now.
So let's talk a little bit more about that book, because that is such a curious line. I miss the war. That's so evocative and seems almost impossible to understand, or I could guess at that. But can you go into that anymore, or how the novel explores that particular notion? Because it seems that it would obviously be kind of discussing wartime situations and what that means, which is certainly foreign to me.
Yes, and to me as well. I've spent a lot of time, of course, in Middle Eastern countries and where things have been a little dicey, even in Central America, but I've never been impacted the way people who live under those kinds of circumstances have been impacted. So I worked really hard in trying to develop the research, not only for what the war is like, but what was happening during the time that she was there. So I did enormous amounts of research, which was difficult to do because the reporting in the history of the war is controlled by whoever's telling it. And there were lots of complex armies and sides and factions in Lebanon at the time. So that was one level. The next level I had to look at was the interpersonal level. What does the war do to you that makes you find a passion? And there's this circumstance, it's almost like the boys in the cave. There's this circumstance where you're up against such horrific things, that the people next to you become more dear than ever. And the people that you're working these complications out with become kind of the fiber of your being. And I only could interpret that as one of the things that she was longing for, because here she was with this man she hasn't known for a long time. She had to develop networks, but she would never develop in them in the States the way she would develop them or had developed them in her home country with people she would spend time in 2 weeks in a bomb shelter with. You get to know people in a different way and at a different level. And people have strong friendships and strong family ties back in Lebanon, very much like a lot of us here, but in when you're going through a war, those things deepen. So when I was constructing the whole first section, it had to be on these several awarenesses, the awareness of what was happening in the larger sense, in the macro sense to the country and who was pushing through and what was happening to her city. And then also on this interpersonal level, what is deepening inside of you that makes you need so much to be with the people you're with. I had just recently seen her at a party in New York, and this is the person it's based on, not my character, and her daughters are in college now and so on. And I said to her, how's it going? She says, I'm a stranger here. Even after 20-some years in the country, so 24 it is exactly, 24 years in the country, she says, I'm a stranger here. She has a family, she has friends, she has, but there's something that going through that terror with other people cannot be duplicated anywhere else. So that's kind of one of the things I tried to develop throughout the story as I wrote it.
It sounds, you know, like a fascinating story, but also a very difficult one to write because those complexities, I mean, even as I'm asking you about them and you're trying to sort them out for me, are so nuanced and interwoven with so much going
right
on, not just psychologically, but the injustice of the war itself.
Right, right. And how unclear it was even for the people in it. Like, there's this part in the story where she struggles about, people want me to be on a side, but I can't. There are like 16 sides to be on. How do I pick a side? Do I pick it through my cousins? Do I pick it? Whose loyalty? And the family stayed pretty neutral in terms of who they were kind of aligning with. They could only protect themselves. It was really interesting. I did a lot of personal interviews, and I found out that I probably interviewed over 50 people, that people would tell me kind of the canned story at the beginning of the interview, and I would just have to come back to them for that, to break through that shield, because nobody wants to go back to the pain. And I had a doctor 5 years ago who treated me for thyroid cancer, and I found out that he had gone to medical school in Lebanon during the war. And he kind of had this anecdote that he told about it that was funny and stuff. It really, really kind of, oh, that's really interesting. Oh, we just moved up the beach when the attacks got stronger and we had parties, whatever. Later on, I invited him over to my house and I'm feeding him. And he just unraveled. He said, yes, I have PTSD. And this is something that has marked me for my life. And he started to let the emotional parts of it come through, and very, very few people will do that. They actually call it the war of amnesia. In Lebanon, that's what they call it, the war of amnesia.
Because you don't want to remember, you don't want to re-experience, which may even be part of like a PTSD symptom, that you wouldn't want to go back to the source of the PTSD.
Exactly, exactly. And I also think, you know, it's a super small country. It's only 52 miles wide, and you live in proximity to everybody. And then to have to hold the anger and the pain for people who are so close to you, it almost seems impossible to do.
Well, that's why it also seems, you know, fascinating. And I imagine this is in other war situations where, you know, that intimacy that you were talking about, that one line spoke to, I miss the war,
right,
is something that's hard to fathom. But of course, as you say it now, that makes complete sense, and also seems, you know, in a kind of existential way, impossible to match once you leave there. That kind of intimacy, that kind of, you know, I've heard that a little bit, maybe that idea coming from veterans of war, where there's a kind of bond with their fellow soldier or something that, that kind of makes their life unravel when they get back, because there's no longer that kind of, they're in a different world, and we don't bond with people like that. So that's kind of fascinating. It seems like it's one of the biggest traumas of war, period, because that lasts a lifetime for everybody that was not just in the war, but you know, surviving it, and civilians.
Yes. And I would love to talk someday to their daughters to see how it was to be raised with the knowledge of these stories, but almost to have them hidden. But they're getting better. Like at the party where I had met her again, her husband, my cousin, started to tell me a story about going to get bread. And at the last minute, he said, "No, I don't feel right about this." And he turns away, and the bakery explodes. You know, and I never heard this story in 28 years that I have, that he's been in the States, and he and I have spoken. And so I imagine there are a lot of these little stories that people just have tucked away in those cells, and it's so fascinating. And the other thing that I think is true about this story is that it has a kind of reverberation across other survivors of war. So it's not specific to Lebanon or any place, you know, or any cultural place, but any place that's had a war. It's really interesting because I was standing in line at Trader Joe's once, and these two women were speaking about their time in South America. They're both from South America. And one of them talked about being in isolation in a prison for years. And I was looking at her in line, and I was saying, if I didn't hear this conversation, she would just be a woman in line buying zucchini and bread and whatever else she had in her hand. But now that I heard her conversation, it was in Spanish, I saw her as a prisoner of war, which is something we don't consider when we see that we have these people who've come to this country standing among us with experiences we can't possibly access and or respect. Or, you know, what my, you know, I was talking to a colleague the other day.
Or worse, it could somehow disrespect, which is, seems to be happening now. But go on, yeah.
In huge, huge, huge proportions. But I was talking to a colleague who teaches with me at Vona, Beth Nguyen. And she was 10 years old when she was put in a refugee camp and then brought to to the U.S., If you meet Beth, you see a kind of regular writer, professor person, teaches at the University of San Francisco, really good with her students, very encouraging. But she had spent the first 10 years of her life on the run and then in refugee camps and then landed somewhere in the Midwest with her family where they were totally, you know, felt all the racism that was there to be had. So it's interesting how people have to reshape themselves, even with these experiences inside of them. It's kind of crazy.
And very powerful. Something, I think, I mean, this book, and I think also these kind of voices, understanding it, you know, for lack of a better word, you know, kind of the other, which is talked about, is a needed conversation right now. And it's not just in this country, but it seems all over the world.
Yeah. Yeah, I think one of the only good efforts out there in understanding the border issue is as AJ Plus or somebody shows each story, each mother and each parent or each parent and each child who's been separated and what that's like. Unless we actually feel that, if we can't be penetrated, then we're never going to shift our policies. We're never going to have compassion. And so I think the more narrative way that we can be exposed to those stories, the better we'll be.
Well, your book sounds, you know, like an exciting way to get involved in that. And I would imagine once the book is published, this this will also generate or potentially exciting conversations or panels. Is that part of the idea when it gets published for it to be a catalyst for conversations?
Well, I hope so. I actually, you never write with an agenda that's beyond the, you know, writing a good story, because that will make the story fail. But there's so many ways I can see connections with other people's stories of survival, and their experiences upon coming to the U.S. and how they reshape themselves. I'm really, you know, really interested in talking to other writers or survivors of these circumstances and seeing how these things overlap. And I would also like it to give space for other people to tell that story. So I think every time a new story gets told, it kind of is the top, it's the top line of a longer list, I hope, that says, now let's hear this one, and let's hear this one, and let's hear this one. So that would be my hope. That, you know, that kind of overlaps with the thing I do with Vona, is if we don't hear these silent stories, then we have no idea who's living around us and what our world is like. We get this very monolithic image of what this country is, or very polarized, and there are no nuances in between. And I really hope that this makes room for us to see and hear those stories, not just this one, but more of them.
Right. So before we go, I want you to tell me a little bit about Vona, Voices of Our Nations, Art Foundation. Can you tell me a little bit about your involvement in that and what's happening there? There'll be a link to the website in this interview so people can learn more. But just to speak a little to Vona, because you just mentioned that, and it kind of dovetails into what we're talking about, right?
Right. Vona is now going into its 20th year. We've been offering workshops for writers of color since 1999, we have had 2,600 writers come through the program, and our teachers...
I'm sorry to interrupt, but this is at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, right?
No, it's actually back in Berkeley now.
It's Berkeley. It's in Berkeley.
Yeah, we were at University of Pennsylvania for 1 year. We experimented with sponsorship from other universities, but we find that our home is actually Berkeley, and we're really happy to be back. And yeah, so thank
you.
So we have 7 workshops, 2 weeks in a row, so it'll be a 1-week-long workshop from everything from poetry to prose to speculative fiction, memoir, travel. Every once in a while we'll have screenwriting, we'll move into other areas, but we're trying to make it, we've tried to make it, and I think we've succeeded, a place where writers of color are not questioned about their experiences or fetishized or patronized or feeling the incredulity of the people around them. But in fact, their work gets to be focused on as something viable and valuable. And we've had over 800 writers get published or move on to graduate school. We've seen enormously good success this past year. For the first time, we've shown up, 4 of our writers shown up in nominations for National Book Awards. So we feel like, you know, and we don't take all the credit because many of them have had other mentors. But I think that places like Vona and Kundiman and Cambilio and Jack Jones and Hurston Wright and Kaveh Khanum have shifted the literary landscape. And so I really feel like this work, and as you said earlier, now more than ever, needs to be pushed so that we can get these silent voices to be heard and seen and to be really paid attention to by mentors who care about the work. And so we feel like we've done a lot of good work, and we're evolving into bigger work. Our biggest successes that are visible to people these days, it's Queen Sugar is one of Natalie Bazile's, our author, and then American Marriage by Tiare Jones was an Oprah pick, and now it's becoming a movie. So we have these really visible successes. And then we have, you know, some things in the literary mainstream, some things in graphic, some things in speculative. So we feel like the work is really important.
That's exciting. I think that work is very important. Elmaz, I really enjoyed talking with you about your book and a bit about Vona. Can you tell me what you're reading now? It's the question I ask everybody at the end. I'm always curious what everyone's reading.
Yeah, thank you for asking. I'm reading two books right now. I'm reading The Shape of Salt and Stars, which is by Jennifer Zocadar, and it's a story of Syrian refugees, and also Girls Burn Brighter by Shobha Rao, which is a story that takes place in India, and it's about arranged marriage and the subsequent of that. And so these two authors have really exciting narratives that I haven't in ways I haven't encountered before. So that's what I'm on right now.
Elma, thank you so much for talking with me today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, and I appreciate being able to talk so much about Almost a Life. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.